Hi, I'm Kyra Kellawan, an international educator with experience of careers and college counselling in schools and universities across four countries. You're listening to the Piloted Podcast, a show about innovation in education for teachers, parents, and students. This episode took me to Australia, where I met and interviewed husband and wife team David and Claire Price, whose organisation, Educational Arts, works with schools globally to transform engagement in learning for students and teachers. Through leadership of the Radical Learning Futures Project, David and Claire have developed innovative approaches to transform engagement, building on what works in schools in the UK, USA and Australia, and they offer practical how-to training programmes for school leaders and teachers. I was lucky enough to attend one of their trainings at Hilltop Road Primary, a public school in Parramatta, in a suburb of Western Sydney, in March this year.
We're really happy to see you all here today, to really learn about project-based learning. We've got the pleasure to have David Price and Claire Price here. We've been working with them for about over 6 years, I'd say.
I think it might be
seven now. So fantastic. I sort of slotted in there in some of that time frame as well. So definitely set us up for our journey. It's such a worthwhile experience. They're an absolute wealth of knowledge, and we've just been able to work with them in terms of getting their advice, coaching, which has really supported the staff. So you'll probably see a lot of our staff coming up, giving them a hug because they're a big part of the Hilltop Road family now. But it doesn't cease to surprise me that every time they present with such the same enthusiasm, same passion, which you'll get today. And I'm really excited for you to really get stuck into doing the projects and actually being immersed in that experience yourself. So it's going to be a fantastic 2 days. So have a wonderful day of learning.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Could you just indicate your level of experience of project-based learning? In other words, 5 years, I'm really only just coming to get the day off work because I know all about this stuff. And one is, what's project-based learning? So just raise the number of fingers that would accord with your experience. Lots of threes and twos. So we go at a fair old lick when we do this. Partly because there's just a lot of stuff to cover, and partly because we're kind of excitable, as Renee said. Some of you who are in more advanced seniority might remember project-based learning from the kind of 80s and 90s. Certainly it was quite popular in the UK, and I can tell you straight away, we're not doing anything like that, because it used to be this kind of hippy-dippy, flippy-floppy, let the kids do what they want. It's not that. I hope by the end of the 2 days, you'll realise that we believe it needs to be tightly scaffolded. But we pick up practice from a lot of it from America, which is where the resurgence in project-based learning started. Around about the turn of the century, we started working with schools in San Diego called High Tech High, and I co-wrote a book, which is a teacher's guide, which you will get. It's a 100-page guide, step-by-step. So a lot of the stuff we're doing over the next 2 days is also in the book.
I met David after reading his book, Open, How We'll Work, Live and Learn in the Future, and I became a little bit obsessed with his vision that anyone with access to technology who is community-minded can change the world. He's known as a learning futurist, and he and Claire are uniquely committed to making sure that the future of education becomes a reality now. Project-based learning, when you start to talk about it, seems simple enough. It supposes that students who engage in a project that is personal to them, that's shown to connect with real-world meaning, can be an immersive learning experience that can build their own agency. David and Claire showed us the introductory concepts of the five keys to project-based learning in this video from Edutopia.
When you think about traditional learning, you think of a student sitting in a classroom and being talked at.
Now I imagine a lot of you are still thinking.
They are supposed to be a sponge. The teacher tells them information and they suck it up. That's not the real world. Having them actively engaged, learning about things in their community and doing projects that they care about is giving them that ownership of their learning. It's making them lifelong learners. It's giving them the critical thinking and problem-solving skills that they need as soon as they walk out of your classroom into the real world.
So there are a lot of different ways to approach PBL, a lot of different ways to implement it, but really it all boils down to five essential keys: real-world connection, core to learning, structured collaboration, student-driven, and multifaceted assessment.
In my work as a careers advisor, I've seen countless students who truly understood their focus differently after spending time in a summer job or in an internship, or after they attended a relevant conference or an open day. Things can crystallize for them somehow out of quote-unquote normal school, out of the familiar and out of the cyclical, just as it does for adults. The benefit of projects, as I see them in my work, is always to link students to issues happening in the places that they would be seeking to be employed after their studies. And there is a definite need for students to understand what is happening within workplaces and happening at breakneck speed. As the day progressed, Claire and David continued to talk about building the four C's in students: critical thinking, collaboration, communication, and creativity. Now, those might sound like buzzwords, but they do reflect real needs in international curricula, in university studies, and in companies of all kinds. The concept of project work can fall flat when the audience is just the rest of the class or the teacher. And yet, as soon as students are given some rope, permissions to fail and to relearn, and a public audience, magical things can start to happen.
The key to it, people are sick of hearing about 21st century skills. I mean, we're already 20 years into the century. But it does seem to me that there are some critical skills that employers are saying they're not getting in applicants. And we happen to think that PBL, when done well, starts to develop some of those skills. But it also builds a sense of student engagement if you can get the design of the project right. I mean, we are fortunate to be here because, as Renee said, they're now 7 years into their journey. The staff here will tell you about the problems and the mistakes they made early on. That's typical. Everybody burns the cake, you know, when you first start. But they've got kids who can remember the content from projects 3-4 years ago. And tomorrow you'll get to see some of those kids. And when you hear them talk about the learning, it's really powerful. So that level of engagement is best summed up in this picture. We took a bunch of Australian teachers over to High Tech High, and there's a school there, it's on the Mexican border. It's called Chula Vista, and we were working in the middle school. And as we walked in, some of these students that you see in the photograph came up to us and said, "Can we tell you about our project?" Well, coming from the UK, that's quite unusual to begin with. Usually the kids just look at their shoes. But they said, "Can we tell you about the project we're doing?" I said, "Yeah, what was it?" They said it was called What Floats Your Boat. And this photograph was taken at the culminating event of the project. The premise of the project was, can we make a boat entirely out of cardboard and sellotape and get it to carry 5 students on the Pacific Ocean? So that photograph was the moment when they pushed the boat out. That student's just so relieved that they haven't all drowned. What you can't see are the divers in the water, just in case anybody didn't get the calculations right, and you can't see the parents who were nervously waving the kids off by the shore. But it was amazing having these kids being grilled by these Aussie teachers, because we said, you know, well, what did you learn in doing it? And they said, "Oh, we learned about the principles of flotation and dispersal. We learned about density of materials. We did a mock-up on Google SketchUp. We tried it at a scale model, and then eventually we did this." And that was, it was about a year ago that the students had done it, and it was all still fresh in the mind. So there's something about the content sticking when it's put in this very practical format. And one of my favorite quotes is by Laszlo Bock, who used to be head of people operations at Google. And he says, "The world no longer pays off on what you know. It's interested in what you can do with what you know." And that, I think, is the key difference between inquiry-based learning, which is about acquiring all that knowledge, but not actually applying it. And in projects, that's what you're doing. That's the key distinction.
At my last school, a student who joined us from an American-style project-based collaborative learning model was feeling that the British form of instruction was much more didactic, and he was right. He expressed a desire to build a space in the school where students could tinker with tools, experiment with making, and suddenly a maker team of 20 students was assembled to meet twice a week. Less than a year later, the school had indeed invested in a maker space, all because this 16-year-old kid had made such an eloquent argument, gathering lists of tools, equipment, safety concerns, and costs, and we'd helped him take this to the senior leadership team. Imagining what kind of collaborators these students will go on to be and what other kinds of creative solutions they would design to the things that they consider relevant to them, it fills me with real hope. And that happened to be very nice to mention on their university applications, of course. But none of them did it for that. They had a different intrinsic motivation.
All of the things that you normally do in terms of your teaching would be a part of how you deliver a project. We like to say it's a kind of wraparound. It's not a pedagogy in itself. And it is not kids designing projects. I would make an exception when they're in their senior years. There are some times when it's good to let kids actually design their own project. Here, they do a remarkable thing. They have parents designing projects, which is just fantastic to see. And I would urge you to talk to some of the staff here about those parent design projects. But it's a great way of getting parents to understand what's going on in the school, is to have them do projects themselves. You saw in that film, they talked about five key components. People differ in terms of listing what are the absolute essential elements. This one from PBL Works, I think, is pretty good. I'll read it out because I don't think you'll be able to see it at the back. They talk about a public product, or it could be a service. That's really important, with an authentic audience. So by that, I mean, it's not a project if the kids are doing, you know, death by PowerPoint to the senior leadership team at the school on a wet Thursday. Oh, you don't get wet Thursdays here. But, you know, that's typically what I see a lot in the UK. And the kids don't appreciate it. The staff certainly don't appreciate it. You need an authentic public audience. It's about a challenging problem, a question that you're trying to solve. And actually, designing those is a skill in itself. Sustained inquiry. So you are trying to solve a problem, which means that you have to understand certain key concepts. And your skill as the designer of that project is to make sure there's no other way to fulfill the brief of that project other than to learn about these key concepts. What some people make the mistake of is thinking you can't do the project until you've mastered all these key concepts. Student voice and choice within limits. I think as you will start to design your project, you get better at making sure that the students have some element of choice in it. But it isn't a free-for-all.
Often when schools first embark on PBL, they get so excited they want to kind of do projects every term that are bigger than Ben-Hur, with everything going on in them, and you know, by the end of the year everybody's collapsed in a heap. So your students don't suffer from project fatigue and you don't suffer from project fatigue. It's also thinking just about clever, small projects which start to introduce some of those elements like the drafting, the critique, or just that idea of going beyond the classroom and meeting people in our community who can support our learning.
Last one. And exemplars from this are actually at the back of the room. It was done here. Humans, I don't know if you've come across that project, Humans of New York, but it was an adaptation of that, Humans of Hilltop. All the people who come here and volunteer, and there are many, many different types of people come and volunteer to help the kids. They were interviewed and there was a portrait photograph taken of them. There was a website created. There was a little pen picture and an analysis of the technical aspect of taking the photo. So kids weren't just using iPads, they were using single lens cameras. They had to learn about lighting, how you would do that properly. But they also were able to learn about the history, and they asked people to bring an artifact in there, something that had special significance.
But you can see the adult world skills that their kids are using, interviewing, researching, writing, photography, editing. So adult tools are definitely in play.
After day one, 60 educators who had been near beginners to the concept of project-based learning went home with a basic understanding of how to create a project, what a guiding question was, and why projects always work better with real-world outcomes as part of their planning. We'd also learned how to ensure that projects would offer academically rigorous content, but we had yet to experience actually doing one. So on the second day of training, we learned that we were to undertake a simple group project ourselves, also known as a project slice.
Just a quick recap. Yesterday we looked at how you get an idea for a project. It could be through a product or a service. It could be through a tribute project. Tribute projects are really good. We're going to do the assigning team roles in a minute, and We haven't talked so much about hook events. Essentially, hook events, just what is the thing that you do at the start of the project to get the kids hooked in? And it could just be showing them a video or taking them out somewhere. But it's about the thing that's going to get them excited about the project.
Yeah, I think it's an important one to, whilst we're on it, to think about curating that kind of final exhibition. Because obviously I understand you want as many children to be involved, but maybe think about different roles they could take, or think about the visitor experience, either the parents or the community members. Think about how they are navigated through a potential exhibition.
So you're trying to break it down to the kids so that it starts to become attainable. It's not about saying to the kids, I want you to do an exact copy of this. Absolutely not. But it is about sharing with those kids what is it that makes this, as we call it, beautiful work or not. Sometimes you can share models that are far from perfect. So think about how the project's going to be chunked up so that the experience of the audience is an engaging one. We've had teachers who have a go at doing the project themselves and then they can share that with the students before, as they introduce the project, and get the students to critique the work that you've done. So we're going to go into a model critique, and this is by way of introducing the project. The slice that we're going to do with you this morning is called Acts of Kindness and Acts of Courage. In addition to all the tragedy of the last few months, there's been this outpouring of generosity. So we're going to leave it up to you whether you choose an act of kindness or an act of courage.
The tragedy David was referring to, of course, was the rampant set of bushfires that had taken place across so much of Australia in the first months of the year. So many Australians had been affected in such profound ways by the economic, social and environmental impact of the fires that it was a subject that David and Claire knew would instantly resonate with the learners. The project slice, or group activity for the trainees, worked to a brief set by Claire and David, although usually this would have been co-created with students. The group members had to self-assign roles, writers, producers, networkers, researchers, to create a joint piece of work based on the concept Acts of Kindness, Acts of Courage, which was then to be presented to the other groups that afternoon. Their research would have to include personal storytelling linked to curricular themes of art, English and science.
So, what I'm going to now talk you through is our slice. So, the driving questions, if we're, and you have kind of two options, sort of two lenses to bring to this. If your group is going to work on an act of kindness, then how have members of our community inspired us through their bravery or kindness? What can we learn from their desire to help others? What makes us happy? What is the science of happiness? What is happening to us when we practice kindness? And quite similarly with the courage one, how have our community shown courage in the face of adversity? How do people overcome their fears? What is happening physiologically when they are afraid? What are the benefits of acts of courage upon others? What we're suggesting today is we are going to co-create a book. The idea would be, if this was a real project, that we would be looking to connect with a relevant charity and sell the book proceeds to go to the charity. The book is going to be a collection of short stories sharing acts of kindness or courage as practiced within our community, and each story will be illustrated.
We've not set this up correctly because we've just thrown in that science. This is an English / science / art project. Each of your presentations needs to have some element of STEM in it, and we're not going to be prescriptive about that because it depends on the story, but you'll find some aspect of that as you go through it, and we also need to have some aspect of illustrative work, and we're leaving that open.
Okay, so we have a full project brief here, and in a minute we're going to move you into groups of six. In your group you'll share your ideas, your stories, don't do too much blow by blow, but land on one of them, just choose one, don't get too hung up which one, but choose one. So whoever's story it is, they'll be asked to write, using our assessment criteria, write no more than a side of A4. We need then somebody who's going to act as the illustrator to pull together appropriate images. The researcher's role, one will look at the social historical context around the story. the other researcher will look at kind of what are the STEM links. So we've already indicated STEM links around maybe the science of happiness or science of courage, but you also might interpret something differently depending on the story. The producer's job, they're the ones who are going to basically collate all of this into a designed sort of 2 or 4 page spread of what their book pages might look like. And then finally, our networker, their job is to look at, well, who out there can we connect with to support our project? Is there a university professor who's a specialist in our particular story's context? Is there a charity or an organisation in the city who might be able to offer us some specialist expertise? Imagining if this was a real project, how would we enhance it with those adult world connections? Now, each of you will take one of these roles and you will lead on that bit, but of course you'll also help each other.
Some of those stories that we heard that day really were emotional, and it took a lot of courage for the educators to share them with each other, given that they'd known each other less than 48 hours. In their groups of 5 or 6, the educators had brainstormed a 6-word poem, presented their stories, and made all of the intended curriculum links that they wanted to use with their students. We listened in to one of the presentations.
So it houses a brave beyond words. I live out at Oakdale, so near where the fires were impacted. And my mother, who's also a teacher, she teaches at Buxton, which is one of the schools that was heavily impacted by the fires. And one of their community members, a teacher that she works with, was one of the fireys that actually passed away. So this is a bit of a story about that. The red beast roared as it engulfed everything in its path. Most would run and not look back, but our fearless soldiers are the only thing standing between safety and complete and utter destruction. The locals, man and beast, are divided as to whether to stay or go. Many who stay are oblivious to the impending doom, unlike the Yellow Army arriving in their red tanks, who do not have the luxury of choice. The haze continues to glow and engulf everything in its path, pushing in further back towards homes, livestock and the innocent. What possesses our firefighters to risk their lives every day? To wake up in the morning and go to work not knowing whether they will return to the warmth of their loved ones. The Black Summer. Over 30 people dead, an estimated 1 billion animals dead, 18.6 million hectares scorched. So again, what possesses our firefighters to fight against all odds? Is it the altruism at its strongest, the notion that someone else's well-being is more important than your own, or simply an act of courage? The adult world connection, so that's linking to the Rural Fire Brigade, the local community affected by the bushfire, organisations to work with, so there were several charity groups that emerged from this, basically providing for families who have lost. The final culminating event would be at the local RFS station or community hall. The STEM aspect, so we've got some notes there about how it links to STEM.
So there was a lot of environmental effects. Lots of air pollution, water pollution, causing a lot of death from the ecosystems. The ecosystems were all wiped out. Extinctions and stuff like that. So that's just general knowledge about what happened during the fires. But, I mean, we could get the students to do graphs as in math.
Oh, the history of bushfires. It's all sort of self-explanatory. It's all there, really. I just tried to make the link, well, the distinction between natural disaster and hazard. If you guys don't need any history, you kind of know that distinction. And the fact that there are a lot of bushfires that are just hazards but not disasters because of the management strategies and the response strategies around it. So that enforces the importance of firefighters in preventing disasters.
6-word, disastrous bushfires, brave firefighters, brave for country.
Is that it? Brilliant. Thank you.
After the introduction to the project slice, we had heard from some Hilltop Road primary students about their own projects. And we'd seen confident presentations from kids between 6 and 9 years old, some of whom who had been involved in their projects for several years. Hilltop is just one primary school doing things differently, but the effects of their students' confidence and ownership of their learning that we could clearly see was a testament to the global citizens they are in the process of creating. And if you want proof, just take a look at their Twitter account, @HilltopRoadPS. where you can see their students taking over the feed for communications as the COVID-19 situation was unfolding. The power of PBL to keep learning relevant, personal, and current had been proven to me at this training, and it encouraged me to want to talk to Claire and David more about their work. Join me for part 2 of episode 2 as I find out whether they prefer working with students or training teachers, and what some of their favourite projects around the world look like. And if you've enjoyed this episode, feel free to give us a follow or a review on the platform you found us on. See you next time. You can stay up to date on Pilot Ed by following us on Instagram and Facebook at The Pilot Ed Podcast, or you can say hi on Twitter, just at The Pilot Ed. Thanks for tuning in.